ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for your patience. My name's Alex Chernoff. I'm the Chancellor of the University, and the rain has held up our principal prize speaker, but he's here now so we can commence. So, Dean of the Faculty, Professor Margaret Abernathy, Dr. Matthew Butland, who actually wears two hats tonight, the Chairman of the Victorian Competition and Efficiency Commission, and President of the Victorian Branch of the Economic Society of Australia. Our guest speaker this evening, as you know, is Nobel Laureate Professor Joseph Stiglitz, and we welcome him as well as Mrs. Stiglitz. We also welcome Mrs. Helen Benoy, the niece of the late David Finch, and I'm sure there are other distinguished guests whom I also welcome and leftovers, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the University, I extend to you all a very warm welcome to the annual David Finch Lecture. I begin in a customary way by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, who are the traditional owners of this land, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. I also acknowledge our partner for this year's David Finch Lecture, the Economic Society of Australia, and thank it for inviting Professor Stiglitz to Australia as the inaugural speaker for the Eminent Speakers series sponsored by Qantas and PricewaterhouseCoopers. Tonight is the 14th Finch Lecture. Over the years, the faculty has developed the fine tradition of attracting to this event the world's leading economics and finance experts from academia, government, and international agencies. Since 1997, the David Finch Lecture has been given by a number of renowned international speakers, ranging from Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard, Stanley Fisher, the then Deputy Director of IMF, Dr. Supachi Panchipatki, Deputy Prime Minister of Thailand, and other notables. And tonight, this tradition continues. It is a great privilege for us to have Professor Stiglitz as the 2010 David Finch Lecturer. He will be introduced shortly by the Dean of the Faculty, but first it's appropriate to say a few words about David Finch, in whose honour this lecture series is named. It is really through his generosity and foresight that we're able to have this wonderful event each year. He was an alumnus of this university, graduating from here with joint honours degrees in commerce and arts in 1944, and in 1948 he completed a PhD in Sir Howard Davis Institution. He was, I think, last year's lecturer, the David Finch Lecturer. And after a short time at the University of Tasmania, David Finch was appointed to the newly established International Monetary Fund, where he spent the rest of his working life. By the time he resigned in 1987, he was Councillor and also Director of the Exchange and Trade Section of the IMF. His achievements were recognised by this university in 2000, 2 years before he died, by the award of an Honorary Doctor of Commerce. Now, as I've mentioned, Professor Margaret Abernathy, who also holds the Chair of Managerial Accounting, will introduce the guest speaker. She's held the office of Dean for 7 years, and as you may know, in 2008, she was named Telstra Businesswoman of the Year for her significant contribution to the community and the government sector. She's a much valued member of the university leadership team, and as Dean has played an integral part in the implementation of the Melbourne model at the university and this faculty in particular. It is in this context that she led the way for a major rethink of the BCom and also the creation of the Graduate School of Business and Economics. It was under her leadership that the faculty was renamed to carry its present title. And it would not be overstating the position if I were to say that she's a staunch, and I emphasise staunch, champion of the faculty. And I say that as an alumnus of it. It is also appropriate to mention that Professor Abernathy was primarily responsible for the university constructing this wonderful building to the south that houses the faculty's graduate school, affectionately known as the spot. There were other alternatives, but they were unacceptable. Now, not only was she closely involved in this design and commissioning, but she became the de facto clerk of works of the whole project. And as you can imagine, what a challenging task it was, given the need to keep a large and flourishing faculty on the move while design and construction proceeded, which had to be supervised by the Dean almost on a daily basis. Now, I had the pleasure of working with Professor Abernathy on a number of university projects. She made considerable contributions to each of them, particularly in terms of her objective analysis of issues and leadership. And I can assure you, I would rather have Maggie on my side than against me. It is now a great pleasure to call on Professor Abernathy to introduce the Nobel Laureate, Professor Joseph Stiglitz.
Thank you, Chancellor, for those kind remarks. I like to have you on my side too. Good evening, friends, colleagues, students, distinguished participants of this lecture, jointly sponsored by the faculty and the Economic Society of Australia. I'd also like to have a special welcome to Professor Stiglitz, his wife Anya, and also the family of David Finch. Professor Stiglitz is known to us all here tonight. That's why we have got this lecture theatre full plus two others. It's quite difficult to actually summarise in a few minutes the impact of his work, but I will give it a try. Joseph Stiglitz is professor at Columbia University and chair of the university's Committee on Global Thought. He is also co-founder and executive director of the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia. He's a graduate at Amherst College. Professor Stiglitz received his PhD from MIT in 1967 and became a full professor at Yale in 1970, in such a short period of time. Professor Stiglitz has taught at some of the world's most renowned universities, including Princeton, Stanford, MIT, and was the Drummond Professor and a fellow at All Souls College at Oxford. Professor Stiglitz's contribution to the Academy is almost second to none. He helped create what all of us know was a new branch of economics, the economics of information, exploring the consequences of information asymmetries and pioneering such pivotal concepts as adverse selection and moral hazard, which have now become standard tools not only of theorists but of policy. And there's very few of us whose research has not been influenced by this work. He's made major contributions to macroeconomics and monetary theory, to development economics and trade theory, to public and corporate finance, to theories of industrial organization and rural organization, and to the theories of welfare economics and of income and wealth distribution. Professor Stiglitz has been recognized in a number of ways for his contributions over his career. In 1979, he was awarded the John Bates Clark Award, given biennially by the American Economic Association to the economist under 40 who has made the most significant contribution to the field. And of course, the most distinguished award, in 2001, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his analysis of markets and asymmetric information. And again, in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize as the lead author of the 1995 report on the Intergovernment Panel of Climate Change. Recognized around the world as a leading economic educator, Professor Stiglitz has written textbooks that have been translated in more than a dozen languages. His book, Globalization and Its Discontents, has sold more than 1 million copies around the world. His newest book, and I saw a few of you here with it under your arm, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, was published just earlier this year. But Professor Stiglitz is one of those rare individuals who's not only influenced the Academy, but he's influenced government and policy. He was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers from 1993 to 1995 during the Clinton administration. He served as the council's chairman from 1995 to 97. He then became the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank between 1997 and 2000. In 2008, he was asked by the French president to chair the Commission on the Measurement of Economic Performance and Social Progress. In 2009, he was appointed by the President of the United Nations General Assembly as chair of the Commission of Experts on Reform of the International Financial and Monetary System. I could go on for pages. You can see by this brief summary that we are certainly very privileged to have you, Professor Stiglitz, address us tonight as the David Finch Lecturer. I welcome you to the podium. We'll have the lecture for about 45 minutes, and then we will have questions for about 15. Over to you. Did you want to lapel?
No, or? I have them all that, and I just want to make sure this can. Okay. Oops. Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. The subject of my talk is one aspect, or one of the many lessons that have come out of the global financial crisis. What I'm going to do is spend the first part of this talk really on basic economic principles about how market economies function. And then the second part, I'm going to be talking about the application of these principles to finance, in particular to trying to make our global financial system work, or at least work a little bit better than it has in recent years. Well, let me begin by talking about the notion of Adam Smith's invisible hand, which is probably the most influential idea in economics. It was in Adam Smith's book, Wealth of Nations, that was written in 1776, which argued that individuals and firms, in the pursuit of their self-interest, would be led as if by an invisible hand to the well-being of society. And it's an idea that really underlays our belief in the free market economy, the notion that firms and individuals in making their own decisions are led to some sense of economic efficiency. Well, it took economists 175 years to prove the sense, figure out what sense was Adam Smith right, and to prove the conditions under which it's true. That was the great achievement of Kenneth Arrow and Gerard Debreu in the 1950s, for which they both got the Nobel Prize. One of the lessons of that research was that, in fact, the conditions under which Adam Smith's insight were actually much more limited than is popularly understood. There are many conditions that have to be satisfied. But probably more influential in understanding the limitations of Adam Smith's invisible hand is actually looking at the behavior of what's happened in the markets. I don't think anyone really believes that the pursuit of self-interest by American bankers, which might be called greed, led to the well-being of everybody in our society. Quite the contrary. It actually led to what you call in Australia the GFC, the Global Financial Crisis. Australia's contribution is this acronym, which is one of the things I will bring back to America. But not only did American financial institutions engage in their pursuit of self-interest, bring on this global financial crisis. If you look in more detail what they were engaged in, you can't help but be a little bit revolted. Much of the profits of our financial sector was related to predatory lending. They actually picked out the least educated, poorest Americans, and sold them products that were inappropriate to them, charging them very high interest rates, and focusing on how to maximize the amount of money they could get out of them. And there's been really some very good documentary movies that really show exactly what they were engaged in. They were also engaged in anti-competitive practices that led to supernormal profits. One aspect of that anti-competitive practices were the those associated with credit cards and debit cards. You may not, well, you, in Australia is one of the few places in the world that have actually dealt with this problem. But in most of the world, individuals don't know that every time they use a debit card or a credit card, the merchant has to pay anywhere from 0.75% to 3%, 4%, or 5% to the banks. And the merchant pays it, but of course, there's nothing free in life. The merchant passes it on to all the consumers, including the cash consumers, because a restriction that Visa and MasterCard impose is that the merchant has to honor all cards and cannot let the consumer know how much he's paying and cannot charge him for the benefit, for the right to use that card. So it's a explicit restriction not to allow the price system to work and not to be transparent. So it's in effect a transaction tax. It's a tax on every transaction, but it doesn't go for public purpose. It's a transaction tax that goes to the coffers of the banks. And we're talking about huge amounts of money, you know, $30 billion a year or more that goes to the banks as a result of these fees that are a result of their non-competitive practices. In fact, modern technology allows for the creation of an efficient electronic payments mechanism. It should cost really pennies, fractions of a cent. When you go into a store and buy a good, to transfer money from your bank account to the merchant's bank account. It should really be almost costless to make that transaction, and yet they charge, as I say, anywhere from 0.75% to 3-4% for that transaction. So if there was ever evidence of a failure of competitive market processes, this is an example. Now, it's interesting, in the United States there is a lot of discussion on this issue, and Australia is was the one part of the world, one country that actually began recognized this problem earlier than others, just like you had better financial regulation more generally than the rest of the world. There were other aspects of what the banks did. Their deceptive accounting was really very impressive. It was very creative, but not in ways that enhance the well-being of our society. And interestingly, having invested in this creative accounting, they then marketed that creative accounting all over the world and found governments and other firms around the world willing to buy these brilliant ideas. Well, the problem was that while the banks were doing what they shouldn't have been doing, they weren't doing what they should have been doing. And what they should have been doing is actually very important. I mean, banks are very important. Financial institutions are very important to the functioning of a modern economy. And you really can't have a modern economy without a well-functioning financial system. And that's why I've been very critical. It's because I think the financial system, the banks, are really having a very important role to play, but they didn't do that. Their roles are actually fairly simple. Their role is to allocate capital, manage risk, run a payments mechanism, and to do this at very low cost. That's what we mean by efficient, doing all this at low cost. Well, our financial system didn't allocate capital, it misallocated capital. There was all the flow of funds that could have gone to make our economy more productive, and what it did is they allocated all of that capital to poor Americans, particularly, but other Americans, for homes beyond their ability to pay. It didn't manage risk, it created risk. The derivatives, which could have been used, or financial innovations that could have been used to help manage risk, were actually used to help exacerbate risk. But meanwhile, while they weren't doing what they were, these essential functions, they were garnering huge amounts of money. 40% of all corporate profits in the United States in the years before the crisis were in the financial sector. Now, the financial sector is a means to an end. It's supposed to make, you know, you don't wear finance, you don't eat it. It is, the role of finance is to make the rest of our economy more efficient. The role of finance is by allocating capital more efficiently, by absorbing risk. It allows other people to undertake more risk, higher return investments. And the principle is that in return for providing these core services, they get a fraction of the increment in the societal efficiency that results from their activities. But in fact, they didn't perform these functions, and yet they garnered for themselves 40% of all corporate profits. So in a sense, we were confusing means with ends. They became an end in themselves. Well, in a sense, the question I want to ask in the beginning is, what does modern economic theory have to say about all of this? Actually, a quarter century before the crisis, modern economic theory had argued that Adam Smith was, let me put it mildly, wrong. Now, I mean, obviously he had a very important insight that the pursuit of self-interest provides these incentives are very important. But the statement that he made was not that they were part of making a system, an economy work, but that they led to an efficient allocation of resources. They led to what economists call Pareto efficiency. Nobody could be made better off without making somebody else worse off. To put it in the way, to put it one way, what our research on the functioning of an economy with imperfect information, asymmetric information, imperfect risk markets, the basic insight was, result was that the reason that the invisible hand often seems invisible is that it's not there. To put it another way, that in general, the market economy is not efficient. And that's particularly true in those sectors like finance where information is very important. And what that says is that in these particular kinds of particular sectors, there's a need for government regulation or some other form of intervention. So that's why for a modern society to function, there needs to be a balance between the market and the government. There is a need for, you know, the government can't do it. That was a lesson from the Soviet experiment. It didn't work. It put too much reliance on government. It didn't focus enough on incentives, the message of Adam Smith. But what the crisis should have taught us, that the other extreme, the view of, you might say, of Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, was also wrong. That relying just on markets also won't work. You need, in these particular areas, there's an important role for government, or some kind of collective action, to ensure that markets work well. What I'm going to describe now are some of the very particular kinds of reasons that the market doesn't work well in the financial sector. And that leads to the question of what kinds of regulations can be used to help the market system perform better. So that's the structure of where we're going to go. Well, it's not surprising that government needs to play a more important role in the financial sector, because market failures of the kind I'm going to be talking about are more important where information is imperfect, where there are important information asymmetries. The role of government is not so important, is not necessary in steel and lots of other areas where these information problems are not so paramount. I mean, you still need, there's still information problems. There may be problems of making sure that the product is what it's supposed to be. There are safety issues. There are still other issues, but they're not as central to the performance of the sector. Well, there are two important problems that are posed by posed. The first is called agency issues, and the second are a whole variety of externalities. The agency issue is very simple, that the people making the decisions do not bear all the consequences of the actions. They're making decisions on behalf of others. So one way of thinking about this is that our model of 19th century capitalism was that an individual owned his own firm, and if he made good decisions, his profits were high, he got the benefit. He made bad decisions, he made losses, and he bore the consequences. But in modern capitalism, a very large fraction of all production occurs in large corporations. The CEOs of these corporations don't bear the full consequences of the actions. Now, it is true that Hayward, the CEO of BP, was fired after he led to this $30 billion loss for his company, but he still was rewarded with a $20 million bonus for having his company lose $30 billion. So there is a disjunction there between private reward that he got and the consequences for his firms, the shareholders, the bondholders, and even more, of course, for society. And that's the externality problem that I'm going to talk about. This is a problem that economists and lawyers have become increasingly aware of. Famous book in the United States was written in the 1930s by Burrell and Means, stressed the separation of ownership and control, so that the 19th century capitalism had shifted to a different form of capitalism. Well, since then, things have gotten even worse. Worse in the sense that they've changed, and the separation, the agency problem has gotten worse. The people who invest in these companies are, for the most part, not investing on their own behalf. They're investing on behalf of others. Much of the savings in our society goes through pension funds and other institutional investors. So the people who are making those decisions are not doing it on their own behalf, they're doing it on behalf of of others. So the consequence of all of this is that in making those decisions, they may have incentives, but those incentives are not well aligned with those in whose behalf they are supposed to be acting. And the result of that, of course, is when there is this kind of misalignment, quite often they make decisions that are not in the interest of the shareholders or their bondholders. Quite clear in that in this crisis, the bank officials, some of the bank officials did very well. You know, like the head of BP, they may have not done as well as they would have liked to have done if we had not had a crisis, but even with the crisis, they walked off with literally millions and millions of dollars. Again, in many ways, things have gotten worse in the last 10, 15, 20 years. Many of the major investment banks used to be partnerships. The advantage of partnerships was that each partner took a responsibility of making sure that the enterprise worked well, because they suffered if the enterprise didn't do well. But beginning in the 90s, investment bank after investment bank converted themselves into joint stock companies. And the result of that is that many of these companies, even though after they became joint stock companies, the bondholders and shareholders didn't do very well, the bank officials did very well. So what we have is a series of agency problems that mean that the incentives of those making decisions are not well aligned to the interest with those on whose behalf they're supposed to be making decisions. The problems in the United States are, again, much worse than in Australia. And corporate governance rules in the United States just begin in a very different legal framework. And when I talk to people in Australia, they find it difficult to understand how bad things are in the United States. It's a model of what not to be done. For instance, one of the things that U.S. Congress was debating in response to the crisis was whether there should be any shareholder say in pay. In other words, should shareholders have any right to vote on the pay of the people who work for them? And the general view in the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Business community, is that shareholders should have no rights to say, have any say, even in an advisory context, for those who work for them. You might say, how can that be? What kind of democracy, what kind of accountability is this? And to me, it's a mystery too. But the corporate governance laws in the United States work. Well, the result of this is that, not surprisingly, you wind up with compensation schemes that are very poorly designed. Except from the point of view of the managers. For the managers, they are very well designed. And so just to illustrate this point, our banks prided themselves on their incentive structures. You know, they keep talking about incentive structures, you have to give incentive structures. Well, as an economist, we look at incentive structures and look at the details of them and say, what do they give incentives to do? And when you start looking at the incentive structures that those in the banks had and the financial institutions had, you realize very quickly that they have incentives to engage in excessive risk-taking and short-sighted behavior. They got compensated. Standard compensation was that if there were gains, they got a very large fraction of the gains, but if there were losses, they didn't have to take any of the losses. Their pay was based on one-year performance. So if your pay is based on one-year performance, if you have high variance, you get the big gain, you walk off them with a lot of money, and when it goes negative, you don't have to bear any of the cost. So it was an incentive structure that encouraged volatility risk. Well, before the crisis, I was a little bit worried. Not very worried, but I was a little worried that unless we started seeing the kind of excess risk-taking that we saw, we'd have to rewrite our textbooks, because we have to say incentives didn't matter. Yes, they called them incentive pay, but it was very clear that if we didn't see the excesses of risk-taking, we'd have to say that incentives didn't matter and we'd have to rewrite our textbooks. Fortunately, the one silver lining in this crisis is we won't have to rewrite our textbooks. The forecast that these incentive structures would lead to excessive risk-taking did bear out. What they were doing was very secretive. We didn't get to see everything beforehand, but now that we've seen what they're doing, it does verify that economics does have something to say about the subject. Well, let me illustrate a couple other aspects of the incentive structures that are, to say the least, peculiar. In finance, we talk about alpha and beta. That is to say, there are two ways of increasing returns on your investment. One way of increasing returns on average is to take more risk. In general, if you take more risk, you get higher returns. Now, anybody can undertake more risk. They can increase the leverage, and that increases the chance that you lose money and the chance that you get more money. So you don't have to be a genius to increase your leverage, to increase beta. On the other hand, the other way of increasing returns is to be smarter than other people, to be more efficient. That's very hard. It's almost impossible to beat the market. The compensation schemes didn't distinguish between alpha and beta. And so, since it's very difficult to be better, i.e. to increase alpha, what did everybody do? They increased beta. They took more risk. And so what we got was this drive for more leverage, for more risk, not for better performance. And the incentive structures didn't take this into account. Really phenomenal. Because these guys were using models where they talked about alpha and beta, and yet they never brought that in to their compensation schemes. Another example, which again is a difference between Australia and the United States, many firms pay their CEOs by stock options. Now, when you're going through a bubble and the stocks are going up, obviously you're going to do very well. But that doesn't say anything about your own performance. Your reason your stock is going up is not because you're a genius, but because you're in a bull market. So well-designed incentive systems would reward people for being better than average. So that is to say, if your stock and is doing better than other firms in the automobile industry or firms in the airline industry, then you ought to get paid more. So it ought to be based on relative performance. And this is very common in Australia, I gather, but almost unknown in the United States. I wrote a paper some 25 years ago explaining why this was a better way of doing it. A lot of equations and all that, but the intuition should be clear. And when I talked to people who were the personnel setting the pay or executives of companies, I asked them, why don't they do this? Was it because they were stupid? Or because they were trying to swindle the shareholders? I put it a little bit more gently than that. And the answer came back usually, well, actually, we were pretty stupid. We didn't understand it until you explained it. But now that you explain it, we're not going to change our behavior because it would be foolish of us not to swindle our shareholders because clearly they don't understand this. So these practices continued. What is clear is that there is a problem in corporate governance and also a problem, you might say, in rationalities. The problem with stock options was actually worse than that because stock options provided another really perverse incentive. When you pay people on the basis of stock price, what is the obvious incentive? To get the stock price high. Well, there's two ways, again, of getting your stock price high. Come up with a really good idea. That's one way. But that's really hard, especially for our mediocre people. People, the lawyers that were running, I don't mean to insult any of you, but the lawyers that were running the financial firms, many of these financial firms were run by lawyers who didn't understand risk and they didn't understand the products that they were selling. Their job was managing it. Very hard for them to come up with these new financial products that were going to make the whole industry work better. So one way, coming up with new financial products was difficult. What's the easier way to do it? Well, obviously, engage in deceptive accounting. So what they were very good at was moving things off of balance sheet. And in finance, it's really easy, especially under American regulations, that you could do off balance sheet activities. So you move all your risk off the balance sheet, you record your profits on balance sheet, and your profits look good, and your stock prices go up. So that's what they did. The point I want to make is a very simple one without any maligning anybody. The point is very simple. The stock options gave incentives for bad accounting, bad information. And again, people responded to those incentives. But this is really bad because if you have incentives for bad information, economies can't work well, market economies can't work well when there are incentives for bad information. And so we created an incentive structure that undermined the information system that is necessary for making an economy work. Well, that's the first set of problems. The second set of problems is externalities. The externalities is just a very simple idea that what happens in one firm, one individual, has effects on others for which they do not bear the consequences, and agency problems are an example of that, but what I'm talking about is a broader phenomena. We all know the example, you know, the BP oil spill has brought home an example of an externality. Their drilling for oil has had devastating effects on the lives of people all over the Gulf area. So too in the case of finance. And it is because of the externalities that we really regulate banks. We talk about the worries about excessive risk-taking, but if an individual engages in excess risk-taking, if he goes down to Las Vegas and gambles, we care, but we don't care enough to regulate it very much because the consequences are borne by him and by his family. Okay, it's a limited consequence. But when the banks engage in excessive risk-taking, especially a bank that is too big to fail, then what happens is the whole economy suffers. The whole global economy suffers. The United States was very good at producing toxic mortgages, and then it exported these toxic mortgages. 40% of those toxic mortgages were bought abroad. Mostly in Europe. And every time I go to Europe, I give a thank you note to the Europeans for having bought so many of our toxic mortgages, because if they hadn't, the economic downturn would have been much worse in the United States. But because they bought all these toxic mortgages, it had effects on their economy. So these are all examples of externalities and why it's important to have regulations and actually why some of these regulations have to be global in nature. Well, the problem was that the U.S. policymakers and regulators did not fully understand these limitations on markets, either the agency problem or the externality problem. They thought that markets were always efficient, they were stable, that they were self-regulating. And the result of that is that what they did was three things. First, they stripped away the regulations that we had, the regulations that had worked pretty well. There's only been a quarter century, three decades in the history of modern capitalism in which there have not been repeated financial crises. And that was the three decades after the Great Depression, when the United States and most other countries adopted good financial regulations. Otherwise, they've been a regular feature of market economies. There have been over 100 financial crises around the world since the period of deregulation began in the 1980s. Most of them in developing countries, a few in developed countries, the S&L crisis in the United States, the big crisis in Scandinavia, but most of them have been developing countries, so we've been relatively immune. But they have been a regular feature of economies that have not had adequate financial regulation. But not only did we strip away the regulations, we also didn't adopt the new regulations that were needed as the financial sector changed. We needed new regulations, for instance, in derivatives. But instead of adopting new regulations, we actually passed a law in the United States saying that the regulators couldn't adopt new regulations, even if they were needed. What was particularly remarkable about that particular piece of legislation was that it occurred right after long-term capital management had been effectively bailed out. One company with an exposure of $1.5 trillion put at risk the whole global financial economy as a result of the derivative trading. And the response of the U.S. Congress and a couple of people in the U.S. Treasury was to make sure we don't regulate it. And the consequence now, a decade later, just to show you the role of this play, one company now in the United States, AIG, had to be bailed out at a cost to U.S. taxpayer of $180 billion. Now, for those of you who don't know, $180 billion is a lot of money. I feel it particularly was a lot of money because when I was in the Clinton administration, there were lots of things that we had on our wish list of things to do that we were told we couldn't do. We wanted to have welfare reform that was meaningful to be able to put people back to work after welfare, and that needed a small training program costing $4 billion, but we were told we can't afford that. $4 billion a year. Actually, shortly before the AIG bailout, President Bush had vetoed a bill to provide health care for poor children in the United States. You know, we have this peculiar view that if you're poor, you don't have access to health care. But there was a moment of compassion that at least poor children, it's not, you know, their fault that they chose the wrong parents. So we had this view that maybe poor children should have access to health care so they wouldn't have lifelong problems as a result of inadequate health care. So Congress passed a bill, but President Bush vetoed it, saying we couldn't afford it. It would cost a couple $1 billion a year. And then shortly after that, he found $180 billion for AIG. Well, that just gives you a little bit of sense of proportions here. So anyway, we passed this legislation saying we couldn't regulate these derivatives. Finally, we appointed regulators who didn't believe in regulation. And it was really, it was not an accident, it was explicit. Paul Volcker had been the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, had done, in terms of what central bankers are supposed to be doing, which is keeping inflation low, had done an A-plus job. U.S. had double-digit inflation. He brought it down to 3-4%. Normally, you would have said, having done that, you ought to get an A-plus, get, you know, reappointed, you know, presidential medal. Reagan fired him. Why did he fire him? He wanted somebody who would lead to the repeal of Glass-Steagall, repeal of the regulation that had worked so well in protecting our economy. Well, for a while, Greenspan was held up as the paragon of virtue, but now his stock has come down a little bit with the housing prices. He issued a mea culpa, which is itself very interesting. What he said was that he thought that the banks would have managed risk better. And he clearly did. But what was so startling was that he thought that. Because if he had looked at the incentive structures that the bankers had, he would have realized that they had incentives for this excessive risk-taking. If he looked at the incentives of the banks, these banks that were too big to fail had a one-way bet. If they undertook a lot of risk and they won and the risk paid off, they got to walk home with the profits. If they failed because they were too big to fail, the taxpayer would pick up the loss. So again, the incentive structure at the organizational level was designed to encourage excessive risk-taking. But he also ignored the externalities. He didn't seem to understand why we have regulation in the first place. Let me say a word about financial innovation, because in the discussion of regulation, one of the issues has always been, well, but if you regulate, you'll stifle innovation. The sector prided itself on its innovation. But I think the correct view on what the innovation in the financial sector was captured by a statement more recently by Paul Volcker, where he said he couldn't think of a single innovation from the financial sector that had improved America's productivity other than the ATM machine. But he actually made a mistake, because the ATM machine was a product of the UK, not of America. So the innovation that they did have a lot of innovation, but it was mostly directed at circumventing regulations, taxes, and accounting standards. There were lots of innovations that led to huge risks that were borne by the taxpayers. But if they had been focusing on what they should have been doing, managing the risk of most American citizens, what would they have been focusing on? Well, what is the asset that's the most important asset for most Americans, probably most people all over the world? It's their house. The house is their most important asset. And so you want to manage the risk of owning a home. So there's risk associated with interest rate volatility, income volatility, unemployment, housing markets, lots of risks. So you would have taken all that creativity and say, how can we manage that risk better? What they did is thought very hard and thought about how can we increase that risk in ways that will give us new opportunities to make more money off of the poor homeowners that don't understand risk. And so rather than making products that were better risk products, they actually made innovations that were worse risk products. I won't go through all, in my book I go through a lot of these innovations, and there were some of them were quite incredible. They invented a new category of loans called liar loans, where you didn't have to have any documentation, and the broker would tell you what income you needed in order to qualify for the loan you wanted. And not surprisingly, a lot of these ran into trouble. The interesting thing is that there were alternatives. There are, if you look around the world, there are mortgage markets that actually work. The Danish have a system of mortgage markets that have worked for 200 years. So there were alternatives. And this is just one example. When I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, we tried to think of other areas of risk where the markets, private financial markets, weren't doing well. One example was inflation risk. At the time when there wasn't very heavy inflation, but inflation does go up sometimes. And we said, well, you buy a bond when you're young, and 40 years later, 50 years later when you retire, you want to make sure that the value of that bond in real terms is what you thought it was going to be. So there's an obvious product, an inflation index product. So the financial, we looked around, we looked at every possible linear combination, on the market. There wasn't anything that individuals could buy to protect themselves against the risk of inflation. So we proposed that the U.S. government offer inflation index products. The financial sector resisted this. The U.S. Treasury resisted this. And at first, I couldn't understand why. You know, it seemed to me, you know, we were putting it forward because we said people are risk averse. They would be willing to pay more for it. It was a way of giving security to our old age people, generating revenue, you know, a no-brainer. And yet the financial sector resisted. And for a while, I couldn't understand it until I finally found somebody in the financial sector to explain why. And he said, the problem is that when people buy these bonds, they hold them. Well, I said, yes, okay. Well, then the next sentence, of course, is when you hold them, you don't make any transaction fees. We make money from transaction fees. We want people to buy and sell, buy and sell, buy and sell. And if they buy it and hold it for 30 years, there's nothing in it for us. We're not interested in that. So we managed, though, to work with a couple of the large financial companies that are more public interested, and they persuaded Treasury that we finally did issue these bonds, and they have now, they're useful also to give us an index on inflation expectations. They have a variety of macroeconomic benefits. Well, the fact that the innovation was not the kind that we would have hoped should not have come as a surprise, because the incentives were, again, misaligned. Just like we saw the incentives were not well designed for managing risk, the incentives were not well designed for innovation. The fundamental problem was whenever there's a misalignment of social and private returns, Adam Smith's invisible hand doesn't work. And the problem is that this problem is rampant today in the financial sector. So the key to creating a 21st century global financial system that works is first understanding the functions of the global financial markets. Secondly, understanding why financial markets on their own are not likely to succeed in fulfilling these roles. And then thirdly, thinking about how government can intervene. Well, I've talked too long, so what I'm going to do is go very quickly over the next few things, and maybe in the question period we can talk about it. The principles of regulation, or the major ingredients, are relatively simple. One, you want transparency, incentives, that change. You want to avoid conflicts of interest, to avoid short-sighted behavior, to avoid excessive risk-taking. I have, in talking about short-sighted behavior, I have tell one little story. I'm on a there was a big event in the United States in May when more than $1 trillion got wiped off of the value of American stock market in a couple minutes. And that was, people who believe in efficient markets, they wondered what happened in that minute that led to a destruction of that much value. And the view, even among market advocates, was that something was wrong with the financial system. Well, those of you who've been following what's happening in America may know that there's been an enormous growth of what's called flash trading, very quick trading, microsecond trading, where the speed of the trade is so fast that you have to have your computers located at the exchange. If you're across the street, you're out of the game. You can't compete. And it's called co-location. So all the computers are right there on the floor below the exchange so that they're on a level playing field. They can all get their electrons up there at the same time. And one of the proposed reforms to try to make the market work better, to make people have a longer time horizon, more foresight, you know, let's have things not just focus, so let's have a longer time horizon, was a proposal that if you make an offer to buy a share, you would have to keep that offer open for 1 second. for 1 second. And the market participant said, are you crazy? Are you wanting to go back to the Middle Ages? You know, all the financial innovation that we've been working on so hard, are you willing to go back because of this one day in which we lost $1 trillion? So that's where the debate is today in the United States. The problem is that these flash traders are actually destroying the rest of the market of people who are trying to make the, you know, who think in maybe a day, or let alone a year. And so there really is a negative externality between the two. Well, so there's issues of transparency, incentives. But because of the corporate governance problems, providing incentives is going to be very difficult. And so we have to go beyond that. And so you have to actually restrict risk-taking. Now, this is just a little bit of a aside for those of you who are professional economists. As you know, one of the big things that the banks have been driving at and saying, more and more leverage. Okay, it was a big thing for more and more leverage. The basic insight in modern finance, modern financial economics, is this theorem by Modigliani and Miller, for which they got the Nobel Prize, which said that increasing leverage brings no benefit from a social point of view, or even a private point of view. Increasing leverage, because as you increase leverage, you are at the same time increasing risk. And in fact, there's a negative effect, because as you increase risk, you increase the probability of bankruptcy if you increase leverage too much, and there are real social costs of bankruptcy. So there's a really important insight here that from a social point of view, a societal point of view, this drive for increasing leverage had no social benefit. And yet the bankers all were focusing on, let's increase leverage, even though it was at the same time increase. And there's one view of what they were doing is, what they were realizing is that increasing leverage, they get the upside and the taxpayers get the downside. So some people believe they do understand Modigliani and Miller, but they also understand the bailout. Important part, as I mentioned before, of regulatory reform is dealing with the derivatives. But the real problem is most of the derivatives, the vast majority, about 80%, more than 80%, are written by four or five big American banks. So that, in effect, they are underwritten by the U.S. taxpayer. And so they are, in effect, being subsidized today. There is a broader question that is being asked. The value of the outstanding derivatives was in the magnitude of about $60 trillion. And it was being described by the derivatives industry as insurance. The critics said, it's gambling. The question was, if it was insurance, what was the $60 trillion of products that you were insuring, of assets that you were insuring? It's hard to find them. As we look at what was going on, at least there are some intimations that a lot of this was, in fact, gambling. Well, another aspect of regulation is not only do we have to regulate the behaviors, we have to regulate the structures. That was the intent of Glass-Steagall. We repealed Glass-Steagall, but what the proposal called the Volcker Rule was to restrict what they call proprietary trading on the part of banks was a way to bring this back into power, back in a modern adaptation. Finally, there's consumer and investor protection to try to avoid some of the worst behaviors that I described before. Well, the bill that was passed actually incorporated most. Oh, there's one more thing I just mentioned. is resolution authority to enhance the ability of government to address problems when they arise. The bill that got through Congress recognized most of these principles, and in that sense, it was a major step forward. But it's also, the one way of thinking about the bill is it's like a smelly Swiss cheese. While all the principles were there, there were so many holes to make it, exceptions to make it much less effective than one would have hoped. So on everything they did, I could go through every item on that list, there was a big exception. Take the Financial Product Safety Commission. What they did is they exempted the second largest category of loans, that is, automobile loans. You ask, why should it be permissible to engage in dishonest lending to people who buy cars? And there's no answer other than the automobile industry came in and demanded that, and got it through Congress. And that's true of each of these. So that in derivatives, there's a demand for transparency. And so what we said is 70% of them have to be transparent. The other 30%, the 30% that you don't want anybody to see, you don't have to let them see. So what we did is we increased, it was better than nothing, but it didn't go as far as it should have gone. Well, creating a global financial, a new global financial regulatory system is part of what is required to create a more stable global financial system. If we don't do it on a global basis, there will obviously be problems of circumvention. The problem is that it's very hard to get global coordination. And so what is happening at this juncture is there's been really an abandonment of the attempt to get global coordination. What each country is doing is deciding we have to pass, Europe and the United States, pass legislation in terms of what we think is appropriate to protect us, given what our legislation we can get through, and then afterwards have some degree of harmonization. Well, better regulation is only part of the answer. There are other instruments, taxing speculative activity and better systems of managing global risk. The current system doesn't work very well. One part of managing global risk that I don't have time to talk about is a new global reserve system. If we have time, I'll try to come back and talk about that. Part of the problem, though, is in each of these areas, getting the global agreement is very difficult because of deficiencies in global governance. We don't really, you know, we've become very interdependent. Economic globalization has outpaced political globalization. So one way of thinking about this is back in the 19th century in the United States, we created a national economy. But when we created a national economy, we also had a national framework to regulate that national economy. So we passed in 1863, in the middle of the Civil War, we passed the first banking regulation. Why did we do it in the middle of the Civil War? Well, the point was that there was a belief that after the Civil War, we would have a national economy, and that if with a national economy, you needed a national banking regulatory system. Well, we don't have the frameworks within which to make those decisions today. So let me just conclude. The silver lining on the global crisis is that it has brought home the need for global cooperation, and it's also brought home the risks of a failure. In the aftermath of the Great Depression and World War II, we realized the problems, the risk of not having global cooperation, and we created the current international institutions. But that's more than 60 years ago. And those institutions are really not up to the task of the current global economy. So the hope is, the silver lining on this crisis is that we will now recognize this problem, that we'll seize this opportunity to try to create more effective global institutions to address the problem of global financial stability. Thank you.
Thank you for an excellent lecture, both in terms of your analysis of our GFC, we thought that term was used everywhere, but also some ideas for cooperation and where we should go in the future. Okay, we have about 10 minutes. I know that there are some people that have to leave. We've got some questions here. I think there's a roving mic down here at the front.
Good evening, Professor Stiglitz. It's a great honor for me to ask a question of a man like you, especially as I handed up today what I hope will be the last iteration of my PhD, which is on financial regulation. And I've read with great interest what you've said about a need for a global college of supervisors, etc. And because I have great respect for you and for your work, I hope you will understand that if my question is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, it's not out of disrespect. Sir, I come to this question not from the perspective of an economist, but from the perspective of a lawyer. And I look at this problem, and my thesis in particular dealt with the collapse of the Indonesian banking sector. And after the collapse of the Indonesian banking sector, organizations like the IMF were adamant that Indonesia needed more financial regulation. And I looked at this and I thought this was interesting because, you know, it wasn't that Indonesia lacked financial regulation. It's that they lacked the enforcement of that financial regulation. And when I look at the concept of government regulators enforcing regulation, I see a group of people who are simply not up to the task. They work 9 to 5. They don't understand many of the products that they're supposed to regulate. They lack the ambition and the drive to do it with gusto. And they're open to a great deal of political interference. You know, for example, Gordon Brown, the previous British Prime Minister, said that they had taken a softly, softly approach to Northern Rock. And there are so many other examples. You cited just one in the last 5 minutes. The automobile industry in the United States, working in a political environment that has a very highly developed lobbying system. And that highly developed lobbying system is always going to make the regulator susceptible to political pressure. So the first suggestion I want to make to you is this. Isn't it time? Here's where it's tongue-in-cheek.
Short question now.
Isn't it time to acknowledge that we have a problem? The paradigm of state-based regulation is an habitual and chronic failure.
Yeah. Okay. Obviously, the regulators failed, and there is always going to be a risk that you appoint regulators who don't believe in regulation and then regulatory systems won't fail. So that's why I think that one of the arcs of the designing regulation is to do it in ways that give less scope for regulatory discretion. So as an example, one of the benefits of the Glass-Steagall Act is it's a structural rule. You don't allow investment banks and commercial banks to be joined. So that means very simple. It doesn't take a high IQ to separate those two and to distinguish what are the activities. But there's a second point I want to raise more generally, that people often say, well, you know, how can a regulator pay so little compete with, you know, regulate high-priced those in the financial sector? And an analogy may be useful, and that is when we're talking about drug regulation, everybody agrees that we ought to have drug regulation. I don't think, or at least not everybody, but most people feel more comfortable knowing that when they take drugs, that they've been tested to see that they're safe and effective. Drug regulation is not perfect. There's a lot of influence to the pharmaceutical industry. You would like it to be weaker, but still, with all those imperfections, we feel a little bit of comfort knowing most of the time that the drugs that we're taking are effective and relatively safe. Now, the people doing the testing don't have to have the same insight into what causes a disease as the people creating the drugs. Testing effectiveness and safety is not as complex in many ways as creating these new products. So there are differences on what are the skills that are required. So in my mind, parts of the arcs of regulatory design is to try to think of a system that is going to work with people who are not going to be paid necessarily as well. Now, there are other ways of going about it. In Poland, they have linked the salary of the regulators to those in the financial sector, so that they have tried to even the level playing field. That's going to be creating some interesting dynamics.
We have a question over here.
Hello, thank you, Professor Stieglitz, for giving me this opportunity to ask a question. My name is Stephanie Schurer, I'm from the Melbourne Institute, and my question is about the invisible hand of the market, which doesn't exist. I'm quite surprised you haven't mentioned, closer, like that? Okay. Yeah. I'm quite surprised you haven't mentioned Adam Smith's other work on the moral foundations, which he wrote complementary to his book on the Wealth of Nations. So, the ethics involved, which entrepreneurs must have to make the invisible hand work. And so I wanted to ask you, incentive structures are not exogenous. You talked tonight as if these incentive structures in the system, they were just put in place like helicopter institutions that are just thrown over individuals. No, they are the product of a long process, and they're the product of the participants in the market. And so you have to ask yourself, who is self-selecting into the financial markets? It's economists who want to make money, or corporate lawyers who want to make money. And then you have to ask, so what type of individuals self-select in there? And who's teaching them? So I'm an economist myself, and I went through my whole career through in learning about indicators of success like growth and growth of shareholder value. So we introduced these systems to make money. So people really want to make money who work in the finance sector. So I didn't come across in my whole education any course on ethics. No one made us read The Moral Foundations of Adam Smith. So I just wanted to know from your perspective what you think about what the economics profession can actually do to introduce new moral foundations in the financial market.
Yeah, the point that you raise is a very important one. The point, you know, and it also emphasizes that Adam Smith was much more critical of the market economy than people who are believe in Adam Smith. He also talked very much about the roles of monopolies. That there's a famous quotation that businessmen never get together without conspiring to act against the public interest. So there's a lot of differing strands, but one of the very important strands is the one of that you stressed on moral behavior. One of the implications of this more simplistic view of Adam Smith, the one that I gave in the beginning, which is individuals in the pursuit of their self-interest lead to the well-being of society, is that there is no role for ethics. If that theorem were true, if Adam Smith's theorem, that invisible hand theorem, were true, what it would say is the only unethical behavior would be not being sufficiently self-interested. And in that sense, you would say the bankers were extraordinarily ethical. What modern economics has been trying to do, and in some sense, is to say, well, what was wrong with that statement that pursuit of self-interest leads to your own to societal well-being? And part of that has to do with the issue of the issue of externalities that I stressed. There's another part, though, that I haven't had time to talk about, but that's also important. That, again, in the simplistic interpretations of economics that we leave out, which is whether people honor their contracts. It's another aspect of, you might say, ethical behavior. Now, in standard economics, where there is perfect information, honoring contracts is never an issue. You say, I'm going to do something. If you do it, you get paid. If you don't do it, you don't get paid. So enforcement of contracts is simply not an issue. In the real world, enforcement of contracts is very important. And the way they are enforced implicitly in many societies is people have honor, have ethics, that if they said they're going to do something, they actually do it. Economists have modeled this in a little bit more formal way of implicit of reputation, repeated games, where we've taken out the moral aspect, but said that people have incentives to behave in certain ways that are, you might call, more ethical. So I think that one can try to incorporate an understanding of some of these ethical concepts, like honesty, doing what you say, deception, in terms of these economic models, but they are totally left out of models in which there's perfect information, in which there are no externalities. And that's why, another reason why those models are so misleading in terms of insights into how economies need to function.
Okay, down here. Can everyone hear? No. Can you just wait one second? Why is
I personally think having a global system is a very big problem myself. That having a global regulation system could be a huge problem in the fact that there is no such thing as perfect information, and the fact that human mistake is very much normal. It seems to me a much better idea people have individual systems so that if there is a flaw in that system, it doesn't have the systemic risk. So, for example, the US system isn't so fantastic. If we took it all on, Australia would be in a lot worse position than we are right now.
Yeah. Well, let me say, there are two aspects of that question I want to pick up on. One of them is that we've become much more sensitive to the realization that diversity has value, that one of the problems that caused the crisis was that too many people were doing things that were too similar. And since they were all using the same flawed models, that when the price of housing went down, they all got caught up, and that exacerbated the downturn. So that diversity is actually very important for the functioning of the economy, for the stability of the economy, and therefore you want to maintain that some kinds of diversity. And excessive regulatory uniformity would undermine that diversity and could, in that sense, lead to a more unstable system. So that is a very important insight that people are beginning to finally come to terms with. But when you have a global regulatory system, it's not saying that everybody has to do exactly the same thing, but what it is saying is that we have to protect ourselves in one way or another against those countries that have fully opened up their markets financially have to be in some ways aware that there may be financial products and financial coming from abroad and financial relations with other less well-regulated entities, and they have to take that into account. So that, for instance, the prototypical example of this is Iceland. Iceland was a small economy, 300,000 people, and had a financial sector that was 12 times its GDP, and was very successful in what it did is it went to the UK and offered higher interest rates to UK depositors. And they were foolish enough to believe that Iceland regulation was good and that there was a free lunch. You could get higher returns without risk. So in the model that was being set up, which is a single market, that firms that we will allow banks regulated in any entity of the world to operate anywhere else in the world, that was a natural thing for them to for people to accept. Okay, but the problem is that system can't work anymore because we now know that it is too risky, and that if we allow any rogue state, any you know, small country to have an unregulated banking system, it will engage in deceiving. There will be risk of that kind of deception happening again. So you have to deal with that problem in one way or another. Now, one way of dealing with it is to say we won't allow any other country's banks to operate. That's to close off your boundaries. And but nobody wants to go to that extreme. The other one is a very costly one, is that we will regulate the product of any product coming into our country as if it were produced here, and but that's very costly to do all that regulation. And so the hope is that we can create at least enough agreement about what good regulation is that we can protect our citizens and our economy from external risks. Have some degree of openness, but also some degree of protection. And that's really where the current debate is. How do we get the degree of protection that we, you know, Australia has good regulation, but, you know, you could, if you hadn't had regulation that stopped an Icelandic bank opening up, maybe Australians would have deposited money and would have had the same problem that the UK does. So you need some degree of harmonization if you're not going to have a closing down of global financial markets.
I know we've got many questions, but we are out of time. I hope that we can continue the discussion over drinks. I'd like to thank Professor Stiglitz on behalf of the university and the faculty.